Hello and welcome to Future Building. I'm Matthew Aitchison and I'm Professor at Monash University and CEO of Building 4.0 CRC. In this podcast, we take a broad look at buildings and building in contemporary society and what's coming down the pipeline in the future. We'll talk with invited guests and experts in the field, where we'll cover news and trends along with research and developments in the industry. Future Building is proudly sponsored by Building 4.0 CRC. Welcome back to the Future Building podcast. So if we think about problematic housing and building markets around the world, it's likely that California would make a top three. Now, whether this is truly the case or whether it's just an example that's been used more often in public debates because California is so prominent is arguable. But there's no denying that it's hard to build in parts of California. And it also has some of the most expensive real estate in the USA. Indeed, one of the biggest books of 2025, Abundance by Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein, used California as a kind of ground zero for the housing supply markets run amok, and as a case study for how well-meaning regulation can turn into a blocker for many new developments and critical infrastructure in that state. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of traveling to Stanford University to attend one of the best conferences on the future of building, the Industrialized Construction Forum. Our guest today, Assembly Member of the Californian State Assembly, Buffy Wicks, was the opening keynote of that conference. Assembly Member Wicks's presentation made a few things clear. Whatever the problems that may have plagued the state in the past, change is clearly afoot in California. She outlined an extensive range of measures that would soon be introduced to government that set out to reform the entire housing system, from planning and permitting to financing to development and production. But why should we care about California? Well, firstly, it's really big, a population of around 40 million people. We've also heard the fun fact that California would be the world's fourth largest economy if it were a separate country. But we should also ask, why are the changes being considered by the California government significant? Now, as I already pointed out, California market is a difficult and sclerotic market that has been stubbornly resistant to reform until now. Also, we should consider that other states look to California, and the feeling being that if it works there, perhaps it could work in those other states as well. Also, California has been the epicenter of some really big swings, and I should say misses, at the problem of getting housing supply going. And here I'm referring to classic case studies like Katerra, for example, that we've spoken about before on this podcast. Finally, though, I think we should care about these reforms in California because I think we are having a moment about housing. There really is a feeling at the moment that we have all of the right ingredients for change. A little bit more about Assemblymember Wicks. Assemblymember Wicks worked on President Obama's campaigns in both 2028 and 2012 before entering politics herself. She was elected in 2018 to the Californian State Assembly, and she always had an interest in housing, as we'll hear, and so it was logical that eventually she became chair of the Housing Committee in California. She is now chair of the powerful Appropriations Committee, which I think is clearly very critical for any change applied to this sector. Look, I really enjoyed this interview, the holistic approach the government is taking, the sacred cows that Assemblymember Wicks is pushing in an attempt to turn around what she calls the aircraft carrier of housing. I hope you enjoy this interview too. I spoke with Assemblymember Wicks from her home office in Oakland in February 2026. Assemblymember Buffy Wicks, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, and you can just call me Buffy.
Buffy, as our listeners heard in the introduction, California is going to be the site of some exciting changes in regard to housing and new ways of approaching the problems that have been facing your venerable state for quite some time now. Now, I should start by saying I've had the benefit of hearing your keynote address at Stanford a few weeks back, So before we get under the hood of some of the ideas your government is going to be exploring, perhaps we could start with you and your personal interest in housing. How did you come to the housing issue and why is it important for you?
Well, thanks again for having me. I got elected first in 2018, and realized I wanted to work on housing early on, in part because of my own personal experience. I'm a kid who grew up in a rural part of California, very low income community, a town of 1,500 people with no stoplight. And I grew up in a manufactured house, a mobile home trailer. I was embarrassed about that as a kid and didn't want to invite friends over or have slumber parties. But as I got older, that mobile home that my parents bought in 1976 for $12,000 was housing security for us. It enabled me to be able to, go to community college, go get a 4-year degree, work my way up the ladder from being working class to middle class. It has enabled me to then go work for President Obama, to then come be a state legislator. All of that is rooted in housing security for our working class families. And that was made possible to me because of a manufactured house that my parents bought in 1976, which, by the way, to this day they rent out now. They built their dream home when I was in college. They rent out that mobile home for, I don't know, $700 a month, which they've been doing for the last 20 some years. So they really got an ROI on that manufactured house. But th I think that reflects, a lot of issues and concerns that people are faced with today. And when I ran in 2018, I did 239 house parties around my district. And I was in a different living room every night, and everything from like $10 million, Piedmont mansions. Piedmont is the most expensive city in my district, to low income subsidized, public housing as well, and everything in between. And at every house party, I would ask the people there, 20 or so people in every living room, why are you here? And about 80% of them said cost of housing. And so I knew this was an issue I wanted to work on. So when I got elected in 2018, I dove in head first working on this issue.
Excellent. That's a really interesting story, and you may not be aware of this, but a few episodes back, we interviewed one of the experts on the HUD code. For those people who have listened to every episode, the HUD code refers to what is commonly known in the United States as manufactured houses and manufactured housing, and so that's what Buffy is referring to there. To set the scene, I think a little bit for our global audience who may not be as familiar with the situation in California, how would you describe both the current state of play in your state, and also, if I may draw on you for a historical account, the journey over the last couple of decades that's got us to this moment?
It's a good question, and it is the crisis that we are experiencing has been decades in the making. We have, over the course of 5 or so decades, made it incredibly difficult to build housing in California. We've made it almost illegal to build multifamily housing. We've empowered, at the local level, really the ability to stop housing construction across the board. There's been a number of different challenges that has resulted in about 2.5 million homes shy of where we need to be. I will say, over the last 8 to 10 years or so, we've really taken a bulldozer to some of the regulatory issues that have made it difficult to build housing, with some very strong successes in that. We've tackled streamlining, we've made more land available for housing. We've cleared big hurdles on permitting reform issues and CEQA. We've done more public investment in publicly subsidized housing. So we've done a lot of heavy work. Some of it has been taking on real sacred cows in Democratic politics. This is a democratically controlled state. When there's housing concerns, often you're pushing up against the environmental community, for instance, or the building trades, or other kind of really kind of sacrosanct groups and interest groups. I have the scars to prove it. But I do think it's important because I think we can balance the needs of the environment and our worker protections while also building the housing that we need for our communities. But we've done a lot of really good work towards that end. over the, like, again, as the last, 8 to 10 years or so. And so it feels like we are, housing to me feels like an aircraft carrier that it can't really turn on a dime. It takes a minute to turn it. It takes effort to turn it, but I do think we're turning the crisis. And hopefully, as I look around the corner, we'll be coming out of this hopefully soon with a flywheel of actual housing production, in a way that will substantially bring down the cost.
Excellent. Well, you mentioned a few things in there which I find fascinating and I think would be of interest to the groups. Can two things. You mentioned CEQA, which stands for the California Environmental Quality Act, commonly known as CEQA, and it being so hard to build houses in California. Can I just ask you to retrace just a few of those steps to say, why is it so hard to build houses in California?
I mean, I think specifically around CEQA, I think there were a lot of good intentions around CEQA. And it has morphed into essentially a cudgel to be used to stop any construction of any variety at any time, anywhere in California. Anyone with, any amount of money in their pocket can do a lawsuit to stop any kind of production under the premise of environmental quality issues. And there's environmental review that is required. So the end result is that a lot of projects get tied up in lawsuits and litigation for decades. Or years at least, and then often just stop dead in their tracks because the litigation challenges are too fraught. And I'll give you an example. There's a project in San Francisco, downtown San Francisco, one block from the BART. It was a former parking lot of a Nordstrom. A developer came in, wanted to build multi-unit, a couple hundred units, union made. A significant amount of inclusionary for low-income folks, all the things you want, right? Living densely, right on a public a transit line. And it was essentially stopped with CEQA. And because of that, we have such a sheer challenge in terms of volume of housing that we need. We had major reforms in CEQA last year. How we got there was through I did a select committee on permitting reform. We had hearings across the state. We were looking at permitting reform challenges, CEQA and others, not just housing, but other projects as well, public transportation, resiliency projects, anything where you're trying to build anything. We brought in all the stakeholders. We brought in the unions, the environmental groups, the cities, state government, anyone who has a stake in this. We did a white paper laying out policy prescriptions on how we could solve these problems that resulted in a body of work last year, one of which was my bill, which essentially got rid of CEQA for infill housing, where you already have housing on your footprint. Anything under 20 acres is no longer subject to CEQA. And that was probably the biggest change in CEQA in 55 years in its making. And we're starting to see the fruits of that labor, where now a lot of projects are getting permitted much more quickly because that litigation aspect is no longer a problem.
Oh, congratulations on that. That's really interesting to hear, and I think it sets the scene well. And if I may, I might just take us on a small narrative to bring us to the present. So you've just mentioned the regulatory reform, the white paper, the bill, the changes to CEQA, and that's been, I guess, brewing for some 8 to 10 years. It feels like those issues, certainly as someone who's traveled to California many times in that period, have been fairly well aired. But in 2025, your team, as I understand it, started to take a slightly different path. You and your colleagues, for example, I understand toured Swedish companies to see how they were doing things. Who could forget early in 2025, the book of the year, Abundance, was published by Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein, and it largely used California as a case study for everything that's wrong in terms of development and of new housing and infrastructure. And then, of course, in late 2025, your governor, Gavin Newsom, appeared on Ezra Klein's podcast to announce his interest in prefab and modular housing, and it really felt like he was also planting the flag around a bold housing agenda that was to come. So that's my looking in from the outside narrative of bringing us back to the present moment. And I want to go straight into what really caught my attention in your keynote at Stanford a few weeks back, where you declared your interest in something quite fundamental and something that, for somebody who goes to a lot of such conferences, I haven't often heard. And that was a focus around getting construction costs down and also a focus on what we might broadly term building innovation. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Buffy, and also some indications about how you got to this point of view with you and your team.
Yeah, no, and I think that's the right way to frame it. As I mentioned, we've done a big body of work around really taking a bulldozer to the regulatory issues and trying to streamline and making it easier and create a level playing field in terms of getting permits, et cetera, which is exceedingly not sexy work, but actually very, very critical and important. And a lot of that was also informed by the great works of Ezra and Derek and others who've been writing about this. And again, I think created, we had the crisis has metastasized to such a level when you have tens of thousands of people experiencing homelessness every day on your streets. You can't, as a lawmaker in good faith, see that and not want to take action, Once we did that huge body of work, I started asking the question of, okay, we've dealt with a lot of these hurdles, we've cleared the way. What are the remaining hurdles that exist? And the obvious thing to me was the cost of construction. The cost of construction is exorbitant. And how do we bring down the cost? And from my perspective, that then automatically then requires, well, we have to look at innovation in order to do that. And so I just started looking around and realized through research, oh, look what Sweden's doing. 85% of their single family homes are factory built. We've had some factories in California, fits and starts, some successes and some failures, as I'm sure you've discussed in other episodes, right? Katerra being the obvious one that has sort of jarred the industry, but also some successes, right? And then also looking at Idaho, you have companies up there, Nashua, Geared, and Ottawa. They're seemingly successful. And also some of the more historic companies like Champion and Clayton, who have been building manufactured homes, who have factories all across the country. You have this kind of, I think emerging, so you sort of have some legacy companies and also emerging newer companies who are really trying to grapple with this question. And so I decided to do yet another select committee on housing construction innovation. These select committees are great because they're temporary nature. Bills do not go through the committee, but they really are about ideas generation. It's a place for lawmakers to come together and ask experts from literally across the world, how do we solve these problems? And so it gives a real intentional public conversation for that. So I established a select committee on housing construction innovation that I chair, and it's comprised of, our housing chair in the assembly, our local government chair, our budget chair that oversees some of the housing decisions, and others who care about this body of work in the legislature. And we did a series of trips and a series of hearings, bringing in and talking to folks who believe in innovation, but also some who've been on the receiving end of not having such a great experience. We talked to developers who've worked with some of the more innovative models, who've liked it, and some who hate it. And I think it's important to do that. And also the investors, why some invest and some won't. And I just think it's important to really understand, is this realistic that we can make this a reality? To bring down the cost. And I think what can often happen sometimes in these conversations, especially as a politician, where you're looking for the next bright and shiny object, is you can kind of, be captivated by that, and lose sight of the real question that you're trying to answer, which is how do we bring down the cost of housing for our working class, and middle class families? So that's how we're approaching and centering the conversation is factory built housing a pathway for that? Is 3D printed housing a pathway for that? And if so, what are the things that we need to do then from a regulatory point of view to make it actually a competitive model so that it can reach its goals of having a more affordable housing? So we are in the midst of that process right now. I had two hearings in January. We are working with the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at the University of California, Berkeley, which happens to be in my district. And they've got a body of researchers who have been asking this question for years and years and years. And we've been working really closely with them, and we'll have a white paper coming out here, I think next week, actually, looking for some policy prescriptions on what I can then do as a lawmaker to create a better regulatory environment to have this industry grow and flourish in California.
Fantastic. I do want to go on and probe some more about the white paper that's forthcoming. I expect it will be released before this podcast comes out, but we're going to sort of pick through some of that. But before we do, I've obviously traveled to California quite a bit, and I've marveled at some of the companies that you mentioned, Katerra being one of them while it was still going. There is a kind of obvious overlap and somewhat an irony about California, the Californian economy, and particularly a part of the Californian economy being the innovation center that is Silicon Valley, the Bay Area. There are so many innovations that have come out of your part of the world and out of your state. As we mentioned in the introduction, California would be the fourth largest economy in the world. We've all heard that statistic before. But is it an irony, or is there a logic behind the fact that for such an innovative state, and as the locus of so much investment and new technologies, that California perhaps hasn't been able to crack that to date? Is there any story behind that that your research has uncovered, Buffy?
Well, I would say one, I don't think our government has been innovative, right? And in fact, in many ways in housing, our government has gotten in the way of success across the board. And I think that's been obviously articulated in books like Ezra and Derek's and others, right? And so I think that's one challenge or barrier. I think California's innovation is born out of, I think, a lot of luck, a lot of smarts, a lot of hard work, and all the other things that we have here that allow for places like Silicon Valley to flourish. And having said that, I think if we can harness that innovative spirit and apply it to this, but also through the mindset, not just in the private sector, but having the government as an actual partner and how we can actually achieve such innovation in scale to serve the needs of our constituents. That's where I think that's what I how I'm trying to approach it. How can I be a partner for innovation for the private sector? And when we're looking specifically at housing, what can I do from a policy point of view to create a better environment so that the Kateras of the world don't fail, or Factory OS, Harbinger, there's many other companies out here. How do we allow them to flourish? And I think there's real concrete, what I've learned is there's real concrete things I can do in my position right now to create that better regulatory environment so this can succeed. And that's really the body of work we're going to be doing this year in the legislative session.
Excellent. Well, let's turn to that now, and the white paper that you talked about just before. Hopefully we'll all see that soon. You mentioned you've been working with some experts from the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at the University of California, Berkeley, a wonderful research group that I've had the pleasure of visiting over the years, and personally know many of the people that you've been working with. It is striking. What I have learned about this, and I should also point out to listeners, I haven't read the white paper as it currently stands. It hasn't been publicly released. But what struck me in hearing some of the outlines about it, Buffy, is how comprehensive it is. We are used to very piecemeal change and innovation in this industry, and the almost holistic nature of it seemed quite striking. And I want to frame some of this up and get your views on it. Obviously, we won't have a chance to go through all of the pieces that are in there. But if I understand it correctly, there's a few main buckets that it's trying to deal with. You've already mentioned one around the regulatory framework, so reducing friction in building codes and enforcement, which is a known issue in California. sort of targeting the certainty and improving the certainty of use of new techniques and financing support. And I hear that there's some interesting ideas around backstopping development costs, the alignment with existing funding streams, and of course, something quite close to my heart as a researcher, the proposal of some research and education programs. Is that a fair assessment of the general span of what you're doing? And perhaps can you tell us what you are most excited about or perhaps interested in those suite of measures?
Yeah, no, that's exactly accurate. And I'm reminded when we were in Sweden, I took four of my colleagues, folks at the Turner Center and others, to head to Sweden, and we were en route on a long bus ride, going to and from one of the factories from where we were staying. And the poor folks at Turner Center, I was just sitting there like peppering them like aggressively around like, what's the idea? What are the ideas? Like, I need the ideas. Like, how do we actually create a better environment here for this market to flourish, and so really pushing them, and they've obviously been great sports, and they've spent years and years asking these very questions, so they're the perfect partner. But yeah, we're gonna have eight proposals coming out of this body of work that I think if we're able to succeed in and pass and get signed into law, we will have serious change in this state. In this space, in a way that allows factory-built housing to succeed in a much more robust way. That's my hope. And so, one of the challenges, right, is there's always the sort of risk of sudden closure of factories that developers are very concerned about, right? They see the risk is the risk reward equation is off for them when they see a company like Katerra go under, so. Or other companies like that, right? So is there a way that we can have some kind of a state entity provide a financial backstop to make those projects whole in case of a factory failure, So we're working with the administration on thinking through that. There's obviously building code issues, when you have these localized building and, zoning codes requiring factories to adjust their product, that doesn't then allow for products to be built and, en masse. And doesn't allow them to be standardized. And so that, and if they're not standardized, then we're not driving down the cost. And so can we remove local building codes from factory-built housing and only apply statewide code? So we're all of these different things. And I don't know that there's going to be one thing that's going to be the end-all, be-all solution to this, but we're really trying to create an environment. Another one, transportation costs are really high for factory-built housing. Other neighboring states like Nevada, Oregon, Washington don't have those same costs, and yet they're transporting the same product, but they don't require CHP or California Highway Patrol escorts where we do here. So there's all these different kind of ideas, and we learned this really sitting down and talking to developers and the factories themselves around, how can we create this environment so that so that the competitive advantage that you offer as a business can be fully realized. And so I think there's going to be a lot of work done this year. I'm carrying a budget ask to seed, long-term funding for more research, because I do think when you're talking about innovation, we want to make sure we're iterating and learning from those models. So we're going to have a big body of work, and it's not just me, obviously. It's my select committee. It's other members. This is a bipartisan Democrats and Republicans, members from urban, rural, suburban parts of the state, Northern, Southern California, because we're all faced with the same problem. And I think in the era of the politics we are in this country, it's really refreshing to be working, across party lines and with such a diverse group of stakeholders to actually solve problems, which is what government should be doing.
Hallelujah. We all agree with that. It's incumbent upon me to ask this question. I feel because I know many of the people involved and I've seen you present on this more fully. But what is it about the measures that you intend to introduce that gives you confidence that they will be effective, perhaps where other things have not been effective today, Buffy? What's different about this suite of bills?
Well, I think it's a great question because as someone who's been working in this space now for 8 years and wanting to see tangible results, I get frustrated when we don't see those tangible results.
Yeah.
And I've taken it on the chin politically in a lot of these fights over the years. And you want the juice to be worth the squeeze, so to speak, right? What I've come to realize is I think it's going to be a number of things that fixes the problem. It's going to be the zoning reform stuff. It's going to be the streamlining work. It's going to be the public investment, but it also has to be the cost of construction.
Yeah.
We have to figure out that question. And so this, I think, is a piece of the solution. Is this going to solve all the problems? No. And I think it's easy to fall into the like getting captivated by the shiny object idea,
Yeah.
So I want to be very conscientious of that. But I do think it could be a part of the solution. And so that's where we'll see what happens. And this is what happens often in lawmaking. You do a bill, it passes, it gets signed into law, it goes out into the wild. And then you're like, okay, did that actually work or not? And then you have to come back the
Yeah.
next year and be like, oh, actually, we need to fix this thing or fix that thing or whatever it is. But the folks at Turner looking, going to Sweden, looking at what other states are doing, looking at what other countries are doing, looking at different models, taking that all in, using the select committee process to synthesize all that information, working with an established research body to make our best guess on how we can actually create a better policy environment, I think is the best case that's data driven, right? I think is the best case scenario to actually achieve that change. I hope it works. It might not. But I know what we're currently doing isn't working.
Yeah.
So we want to make the environment better. But I'm cautiously optimistic that this will move this industry in a way that will be beneficial, again, with the whole goal of bringing down the cost of housing.
Oh, look, for what it's worth, as somebody who's has looked at these sorts of proposals around the world, I think you are 100% on the right track, and it's really refreshing for me to hear as well about your proposal for a long-term funding commitment towards this research and doing data-driven policy development makes a lot of sense. And so I think that is a small token of gratitude from me and I think others in the innovation ecosystem for saying it's great to see that that work and that advice not only being heeded but continuing to be funded. I just want to, before we move to wrap up, Buffy, I also just want to step through for us mere mortals who don't spend our times in the halls of Sacramento to understand what the process would be from such a thing like this white paper we're about to see through to bills and potentially even their implementation should agreement be found.
We are introducing bills as we speak, derived from these hearings we've had, derived from the white paper, which will be coming out next week. So the bill introduction is starting now. Again, there'll be about eight specific proposals that we're going to be putting forward that will go through the committee process in the assembly first. Then, one, two, three committees, depending on the area of jurisdiction, a lot of which will go to the housing committee, a lot of which will go to our local government committee, a lot of which comes through my committee, which is the appropriations committee. It'll head to the assembly floor. We'll have to get I got to get 40 people to agree with me on all of these, and so do all of our other my colleagues who are authoring these bills. It gets kicked over to the Senate, goes through the same process in the Senate over the summer. And then back to the assembly on concurrence for the final vote, and then off to the governor's office. And so through each committee process, through each bill, there's a lot of stakeholders that will weigh in. The labor unions will have a say, the environmental community will have a say, our local governments, our cities, our counties, will be working collaboratively with the governor's office. I was very happy to hear him talk about modular on the Ezra Klein podcast, which was great. There's a lot of politics and process as that moves through. I'm in my eighth year now and I've sort of figured out, I think, how to make it all work.
Yeah.
But it is juggling a lot of balls. But I think we'll get there. I'm cautiously optimistic most of these will land on the governor's desk. And I think for the ones that do land on the governor's desk, I'm pretty optimistic he will sign them.
Excellent. Look, you just made one comment there that has come up in many of the interviews that I've carried out over the last few years. And so just before we move to wrap up, I do want to probe again on that. You mentioned the issues of unions and organized labor. That's one of the things. I'm obviously sitting in Australia at the moment. We too have a unionized construction workforce. And rightly or wrongly, oftentimes in public discussions and debates, organized labor is used as an argument, in some cases, spectre for why things like this can't or won't happen. I just want to get your take on it, Buffy. How's your interaction been with the unions, in California?
So I think the unions are not monolithic on this. I think historically, the building trades have tended to not be supportive of factory-built housing specifically. I think that's starting to change, and I know it's starting to change. There's a company in Southern California that is organized by the building trades. The carpenters, who are not part of the building trades, have been much more proactive, in supporting these newer models, and willing to think creatively around what that means. One of the main factories, Harbinger, which is formerly known as Factory OS, is carpenters organized, and has been since day one. And so they've been a lot more, really at the table, eager to drive innovation in this space. You know, at the hearing I had a couple weeks ago, I invited both the building trades and the carpenters to come testify about what their concerns, desires, needs, wants are as we look at this emerging industry. That was very helpful. Obviously, I welcome them to the table. And it's just figuring out exactly, okay, what does that actually mean in terms of factory-built housing? And are you know, what labor standards are you looking at in the factory versus on-site, et cetera? So that's where the sort of rubber meets the road in the conversations. But I have a strong working relationship with the unions. I haven't always seen eye to eye with all of them, always, you know. But it's a respectful and cordial relationship that I'm very eager to have their points of view and see if we can land something, policies that work for them and work for, you know, this space and work for this industry, and work for my constituents ultimately.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much for that. So this is the crystal ball part of the evening, as it were, your evening, my morning. You mentioned before housing is like an aircraft carrier. I love that metaphor because it takes such a long time to turn housing around, and particularly housing supply. So when thinking about the measures that your government is considering, and that should hit the floor at some point later this year, how do you imagine in your mind's eye the future of housing in California? What do you think it should look like in 5 or 10 years from now, Buffy?
Well, it's a great question. You know, fundamentally, millions more homes than what we have at the core, to drive down the cost. We're losing people out of the state because of the cost. So I think that's first and foremost. And I think that's going to be as a result of a lot of different things. Factory-built housing and modular as a piece of that solution, but not exclusively, you know. Additional, you know, multifamily housing, more home ownership opportunities. We also have issues here around building condos because of some of the construction defect liability laws that we have on the books, which is also something I'm working on. So, you know, more home ownership opportunities, you know, more workforce housing, more missing middle housing. I'm a yes and all of the above person, but I'd love to see 50, 60 factories up and down the state of California in 5 to 10 years taking off, serving those needs, as an example, along with the traditional stick-built, you know, and panelized and all the different models that we have, to reach the goals that we need.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a fantastic place to leave it. I want to thank you again wholeheartedly for your time today, Buffy, and I truly want to wish you the best of luck with the passage of these bills as they develop throughout the year. To our audience, as always, notes and references will be added online to the show notes, and we will, of course, include a link to the forthcoming white paper. Just again, a thanks to our editor-in-chief, Dr. Sarah Breen Lovett, and also to Michael Hogg for the theme music. Buffy, thanks once again. And to our audience, thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.